Thanks for joining us on Battle Walks as we walk across the great battlefields of Europe. If you're enjoying the show, why not become a member? Every week, you'll receive exclusive bonus episodes available only to subscribers, and you can listen to all our episodes completely ad-free. Click on the link in the show notes to join us via Acast Plus.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
A Living History production.
I'm Matt McLaughlin.
And I'm Pete Smith.
We're battlefield historians who love nothing better than getting out and walking the ground where great battles in history took place.
And now we'd like you to come with us. Every week, Battle Walks will take you to one of the great battlefields of Europe.
As we walk the ground, we'll dig through the pages of history, we'll uncover the secrets of the battlefields, and most importantly, we'll tell the stories of the people who fought and died there.
Welcome to Battle Walks.
Hello everyone, and thank you for joining us once again on Battle Walks. It's an exciting time of the year where we're getting close to when the battlefield touring season kicks off for real again. We get to get out and walk the battlefields. I should introduce him, someone straight away who loves getting out walking the battlefields, my co-host Pete Smith. Pete, we were just saying how great it is to be out walking around again on the battlefields.
It is. Well, I've been out touring today, so just at the end of a two-day tour, so I'm breaking myself in gently. So great. I'm kind of suntanned. No, I'm not. It was freezing. It was windy, but it was good to be out on the battlefield. So yeah,
it's still February. Let's not forget that.
Yeah, it's true. Yeah, I lied. It wasn't sunny.
I was listening the other day to one of our very early episodes, Pete, right in the middle of COVID, and how much has changed. You know, we were talking about one day in the far off future we'll be able to get back to the battlefields. And here we are doing it. It's changed relatively quickly, hasn't it? It's great to see how many people are coming back. If you said, how's the battlefield touring industry looking? I would say busy. Lots of people are heading to the battlefields, which is great to see.
Yeah, it was. It's good fun up at the gate last night, the Menin Gate, listening to the last post, and then down to my favourite little bookshop, my friend the Grumpy Canadian, and bought a few books from him. I always managed to buy a few books every time I visit Ypres. It felt very normal, thank goodness.
Your favourite little bolt hole, I think you described it.
Yeah, I did.
Well, if you don't forget, listeners, if you want to join us on a battlefield tour, you certainly can. There's a lot of great reasons to go to the battlefields in 2023, including not least of which the Rugby World Cup, which is being held in France. I mean, that's reason enough to go to France. Pete, I know you're a fan of the rugby ball. It's reason enough to go that the World Cup is on, but when you can combine it with a walk through the battlefields, that's a pretty special trip.
Yeah, I'm a fan of the English rugby ball. Let's just make that absolutely clear. Yes, it is. That will be.
I never would have picked that from your accent, man.
E-bagel. How exciting. Rugby and the battlefields, what more could you ask for?
And we've got lots of our four-day explorer tours, which are the dates we've chosen this year specifically fit in with the key rugby matches. So if you're heading over to the battlefields, particularly as an Australian, if you're heading over to the Rugby World Cup, you can walk the battlefields and join one of our tours. So visit our website to find out all those details. Pete, we are going to do a walk today, which it's a little bit of a different one. It's not one that I have much experience with at all. So you're going to be leading me around as much as the listeners. But it's the village of Cassel. Is that how we decided we say it? Cassel.
Castle. We've just been discussing this. I even put the name into a French translatory thing so that it would speak it in a Frenchy accent as how we say it, and it is definitely Castle with more of a French accent, Cassel. But I'm just going with a Northern accent, Castle. So it's going to be called Castle.
This is C-A-S-S-E-L. CASTLE. It's not castle as in a ram, you know, as in a turreted building. We're talking about the little French town, but what a significant town. I can't believe I haven't been here. When we were having this discussion before we started recording and reading your extensive notes, I was just amazed that I've never found the time to get there, because this has incredible World War One history, very significant World War One history, but amazing World War Two history as well, all in the one little town.
Yeah, and even better, it was voted France's favourite village in 2018 on a popular TV programme in France. Which I find quite
extra. I always wonder with those things, what happens the next year? Like, what happened to the town in 2019 that they decided it was no good anymore?
Yeah, well, I have to say, it is a great little place, but I've certainly been to what I would describe as more beautiful French villages. But this one, it's because of where it is, the views from it, as you will begin to realise as we get on with the podcast, spectacular. So it's at the top of a hill, which is one of the more interesting things. And the history around it goes back to almost to dot. So we get the Romans there, the local tribes there, and history, unbelievable. But it's a great place.
By the time we get through pre-Roman, Roman, medieval, you know, the Dutch and the French scrapping around Cassel and all these other battles, we're not going to have time for the First and Second World War, or it's going to be a three-hour podcast. So we might have to skip over those a little bit more quickly to get to the key stuff. But you chose this one, Pete, for a very specific reason, because this dovetails neatly with a fantastic tour we've got coming up that you're going to be leading later in the year.
Indeed. So in doing the research notes for this podcast, I've also been kind of sorting out the routes for our walking tour, which takes place in October. Is it October?
October.
Now? Yeah, in October. So looking forward to leading that. And what we've tried to do is add...
This is our battle tactics on the Western Front tour, our in-depth experts tour, effectively, a really in-depth study of the battlefields for people who've either been before or are going for the first time but want to know what went on during the First World War on the ground. It's a very specific enthusiast tour. We can't wait. Very exciting.
Yeah, and this is one of the locations. I wanted to do a behind the lines location. And so this is my behind the lines location. We're going to be walking. Perhaps we're going to start at the top and walk down rather than start at the bottom and walk up. I thought, let's not be too cruel. So we're going to cover the town, walk around the town, go up and down the streets. And we're going to be talking about both the First and the Second World War, because during the First World War, it's behind the lines, but during the Second World War, it's very much in the front line. So we can cover both the Great War and the Second World War as well.
As part of reading my notes, Pete, I'm sure we'll get to it in detail, but reading my notes for this podcast as well, just doing some research, I noted during the retreat to Dunkirk, the villages that were fortified by the British and defended very strongly against the advancing Germans to protect the beachhead at Dunkirk in 1940. But so many famous names from the First World War and fighting sweeping through there again. Just extraordinary. In our podcast about Hill 60, we talked all about this, about how the fighting returned to these key tactical places in the Second World War. Because I suppose if they were tactically important in the First World War, they were going to be again during the Second World War. And I never can help but think on both sides what it must have meant to those men fighting there in the Second World War to note that they were crossing ground that had been so heavily fought over the first time around.
Well, I think some of them, of course, some of the senior officers and a lot of the men, a lot of the senior NCOs and senior officers had actually fought there in the First World War. So it's even stranger. They are actually back where they'd fought as young men, fighting again in 1940. So extraordinary.
With very different results this time around.
Indeed.
No matter which side you're on.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's a really exciting one, Pete. Why don't we get cracking on the walk? Because I'm really looking forward to it. Can you tell us a little bit about where Cassel is located in France?
Right. Well, it's in the Department du Nord, so the northern department, the most northern department in France, almost abutting Belgium. From the top of the hill where the town is actually situated, we can see into Belgium. You can see almost all the way to Ypres and certainly towards the battlefields. So extensive views. It's a high hill. I've got the height somewhere. Let's see where I scribbled down the note of how high it is.
176 metres. Yeah.
Correct. Thank you, Matt. 176 metres or 577 feet in the old bunny. So extraordinary views across to Dunkirk. We can actually see Dunkirk. We can see the coast from here. So, extraordinary location, high in remembering that Flanders, traditionally, our mental kind of view of Flanders, for those that have been, for those that have studied the battlefields, the fighting around Fromel, the fighting, onto the salients, almost completely flat or near as damn it flat. Well, this is not. This is there are actually a series of hills, but this is the most important for both the First World War as a rear area and the Second World War as a defensive location, protecting that withdrawal to Dunkirk.
Pete, just a little side question here. Have you ever seen on a map the hill that is the town of Cassel referred to as Hill 176, noting how the British used to number their hills based on their height?
No, but I bet you it is somewhere. I bet you it is noted as Hill 176 on something. But no, I haven't. I don't recall off the top of my head seeing it, but yeah, it may be. It could be.
Sorry, slight side note there. I was just interested to know, because they did have a habit of naming hills. Well, famously, Hill 60, 60 metres high. Sorry, I'll let you carry on.
No, it's going to... No,
there
so
won't
the
be
answer
too many,
is,
what, too many more mathematical questions anymore. I'll just get on with the history podcast. Yeah.
I don't like fastballs. I have no idea. I should have been the better answer. I don't know. But yeah, it wouldn't be beyond the realms of possibility at all. As I say, voted one of the favourite villages. So that gives you a start of a feel of what it's like. The architecture is a combination of rebuilt. So it's rebuilt because it was badly damaged in 1940 and a little more damaged in 1944, in fact. But the worst damage is from 1940. It has a certain Spanish air about it because it was built, part of it had been built by the Spanish, so it would have a Spanish feel. And now certainly it would feel like when we go into Ypres and look at that Flemish architecture, those beautiful frontages to the houses, then it has that as well. So I have to say, it is an attractive town. It was a fortified town, so it did have walls all around it. Not much left of the actual walls because the buildings themselves form the walls, but we do have gateways. We have gateways, we drive through gateways to enter the town, so you start to get a feel of what it's like. It's a very attractive town with a slightly run down air about it. You would have to say it looks a little unkempt sometimes. Well, not sometimes, a lot of the time, but it isn't. I quite like that feel of it not being. It's not a kind of a highly polished tourist destination. It feels like it's lived in, which it is. It is a working town. There are people from the farms round about living there, people that work in some of the businesses round about. But it's also got some nice hotels and restaurants, and that's what brings quite a lot of people to the town itself. And what's fascinating, these hotels are hotels and restaurants that in some cases, in fact in quite a lot of cases, were operational both before the First World War, during the First World War and during the Second World War. They've marginally changed because of damage in the Second World War, but they're in the same locations and many of them carrying the same names as well.
Pete, you mentioned the town, well, authentic, because I think a word you'd use to describe the town in terms of it's lived and worked in. Isn't that just a great thing about visiting the battlefields, that it takes us to these places we wouldn't normally go? This is as far off the tourist track as you could probably get, and most people visiting France would never even think of coming to this region, let alone this town. But this incredible history takes us there.
Yeah, I think actually that there are probably more people visit the town who are interested in the retreat to Dunkirk than people that are following the First World War battlefields, because it's a behind the lines location, which is interesting for us when we're discussing what went on and decision making, and also the rest areas, people coming to rest here, especially officers coming up to the town and partying effectively before heading back to the front. So it's close to the front, and it's a place where you could come for a weekend or for a couple of days rather than going on what we normally perceive, the traditional 10-day leave that takes you to England or to Paris. This is a local leave where men and officers can come out of the lines for a few days and relax and have a beer and everything else that soldiers need, and back into the fray again in a few days.
The other thing that I thought was interesting there, Pete, when you were describing the town, is these real frontier towns. We don't think of them today. You know, they're up near the Belgian border, or you know, on the way to the Netherlands. We don't really think of them as frontier towns today. But a couple of centuries ago, these were right in the, you know, these were the northern outposts of the French Empire. We think of those other towns like Peron and Le Quinoa that we've talked about, where the New Zealanders were. Yep. These walled towns, Ypres itself, these walled towns and cities that really formed this defensive bastion in the north of France, and it's reflective of a very different era in Europe at the time.
Yeah, and this one is actually, they didn't need to fortify it as with the star-shaped forts of Vauban that we see working and fortifying these towns, because it's up on the top of the hill. You didn't need any of that. You don't need to build lots of very, very tough defences, because in itself, where it is, means it overlooks the roads and men can sally out from the town to defeat an enemy before he actually gets up to the castle, or gets up to the village and the town and the fortified town on the top. So it was a very important point, and it goes right the way back to the Romans. The Romans built the major straight roads in this area, and this is where they overlooked the roads, and they could defend the roads by coming out from the fortifications they built on the top of the hill. So right the way back to Roman times, it was important.
Well, important question for you now, Pete. Did you want to give us a history of the town prior to the First World War, or are we going to suffice it to say that an awful lot of fighting and battles and intrigue went on in the centuries leading up to the First World War?
I have to say, for those that are listening and are very interested, it is interesting. I've got pages and pages of it that I don't know how to actually condense into something that is easily readable for a podcast. But let's just put it this way. There's a hell of a lot of history before the period that we are really interested in, the First and the Great War and the Second World War. And it is changing hands constantly, as Matt quite rightly said. It is like a border town. It is right on where there's an awful lot happening. I mean, a lot of that is because of literally where it is. It's in a fertile area, great for growing crops. It's near the coast, so people coming up and down the coast can be seen, and raiders. So it's such an important spot for the early development of man that the history is extensive in the period that we're not going to cover in great detail prior to the Great War.
Well, it's probably a good point, though, as well, Pete, as we tend to look at the First World War in isolation, even the Second World War, even though the fighting returned to this area, we tend to look at these events in isolation. But if you think there's a hilltop town in 1914, or there's a hilltop town in 1940, that town was also going to be vitally important in 1671 or 1583 or whenever else a marauding army came through.
Yeah,
these elements have a habit of repeating themselves, and the weapons change and the training changes and the volume of men changes dramatically by the time we get to the Great War and the Second World War. But the strategic importance of areas doesn't change at all.
No, not at all. Population, just to give people an idea, 2,300 people living there. Now, I suspect there's quite a few holiday homes here that may be not occupied full-time. In the mid-19th century, 4,200 people, so it's decreased, and not a surprise. All of the villages that I've ever studied in northern France are the population is far less than it was in the mid-19th century.
Well, let's walk through the town, Pete. Where are we going to start?
Well, we're going to start, and in fact, we can do an awful lot without moving, to be honest. We can sit in the bar or
it's
one
my
of
kind,
the...
Wait. A battle walk from a bar. Yeah. That is my kind of battle walk.
I hasten to add, there may be a little of that in the walking tour, but we will not be conducting the walking tour totally from the bar. We will be walking around the town. But the bar in the centre of town in the Grand Place is an ideal place to start, because from it we can see some of the key features of the town, some of the buildings that will feature both in the First and the Second World War. So we're looking down into the square from a slightly raised pavement. So the pavement is raised above the square, and behind us are the bars and the tea rooms, and we're sitting outside one of those, glass in hand, looking down. And if we look to our left, then which is actually in the direction of Ypres. So looking to our left, we're looking towards it. We can't see it from the town square. We're going to walk up to where we can get a view towards Ypres later on. But we can see the large church, the large Notre Dame de la Crypte, which is the main church in Castle, dating to the 11th century. So again, a little bit about the history. It was known as a hall church because it has a style of a hall. It's a big hall inside, very typical for those types of churches built in Flanders and the Artois region. Again, because we're on the cusp, Flanders, French Flanders or Belgian Flanders, and the Artois is within France nowadays. The Artois, old fashioned regions, now both part of Haute de France, High France. Marshal Foch, when he was based here, and he was based here in 1914 and 1915, he used to regularly go into the church and pray there. And inside, you can find a plaque commemorating both his son and his son-in-law who were killed in the battles of the frontiers in 1914. Now, that is something I'd really like to do a podcast on. It's the French fighting on the frontier in 1914. Just unbelievably terrible casualties. Won't say anything else. It's just that we know little about it, we being the British and the Commonwealth forces, the Empire troops. Our interest still is really in our efforts on the Western Front, and occasionally we talk about the French, but their casualties in the Battle of the Frontiers in 14, truly horrendous. So something we can perhaps look at in the future. Anyway, back to Marshal Foch. Well, since we're
just, I was just going to add there on about the French, Pete. Their casualties in one of those days were more costly than the first day of the Somme. The French loss in one of the 1914
many, many more. Much more costly.
I think there were 27,000 men in a single day killed. 27,000 killed. Yeah, so it's just extraordinary. We absolutely, obviously, this is a whole separate subject. We should ring the little tangent bell. But the French get a bad rap because of the perceived capitulation during the Second World War. But anyone that knows about the fighting on the Western Front knows that for the majority of the war, the French carried the bulk of the load. Everyone contributed, but the French did as much as anyone on the on the Western Front. The other thing I wanted to talk about there, Pete, that you just touched on is, so Foch, the great Allied commander, excuse me, lost both his son and his son-in-law very, very early in the war.
Exactly.
And you've got to ask the question, what effect did that have on him? You know, we think of these great men. We see the statue of Foch triumphantly on his horse, you know, in Paris. And you just have to wonder what effect that had on them, that huge personal loss. Normally a family would take many years to grieve. He can't do that. He's got to get back and he's got to win a war. But I just wonder, there's no answer, of course, but I wonder how that changed his outlook on this war and his attitude to the Germans and just his mental state, particularly having lost a son and a son-in-law so early in the fighting.
Well, I think we can see by the end of the war, he's the driving force of the belief that we should have continued into Germany, as we will do in the Second World War, and give the Germans a damn good hammering. He was not of the belief that the war should have finished on the 11th of November in 1918. His comment is that if we don't do that, if we do not hammer the Germans into the ground in 1918 and force them right the way back to the borders of Germany and into Germany, they will, his prediction, in 20 years' time, they will come again. And yet you have to say he was proved to be right.
He was well-founded in history, because it was only, 40 years between the Franco-Prussian War and the First World War. The Germans were, they did have a predilection for marching into France on a whim at that time.
Indeed.
Sorry, so that was an aside, but just a fascinating, again, these elements of history. We see a little plaque in a church and it opens up this whole aspect of command and Foch and the politics of the war that I hadn't considered before. Fascinating.
Yeah. Yes, and interestingly, he is also commemorated here, riding on a horse. So there is a bronze statue of him here, which we'll come across later on during the walk around the town. I just should say as well, Foch or Foch, I'm not quite so sure how we're saying it nowadays. Over the years, it changes. I've always stuck to Foch because that is how I learnt in the early years of my education of the Great War. But I'm not sure if that's what we're saying now.
The French say Foch. Yeah. There's an obvious reason in English for us to meander a little bit away from that pronunciation. So we tend to go with
I don't know what you mean.
The likely incorrect, but lower risk of saying a bad word on a podcast. Foch.
So back to his story. So he was here during 1914, 1915, during the race to the sea. And he'd previously been based in Doulon, which is not that far away from where I'm recording at the moment, just on in the department of the Somme. And he will move his headquarters, and that was north of Amiens, just to put it in its perspective. He will move his headquarters here to Kassel because he felt it was strategically an interesting point. He gets a view over the battlefields. It's nearer to the Belgian headquarters at Verne and the British headquarters, which at that time was at Saint-Omer. So he moves to here. So he made this his headquarters. And he based himself on the first floor of the Hotel de la Noble Coeur, the Noble Heart. Which is now the Museum of Flanders. So it's directly, almost directly opposite, slightly left of where we're sitting, so we can see the Museum of Flanders across the square, and that's where he based himself. So we are surrounded by places and buildings and locations that are very relative to the occupation here, or not the occupation, the senior command that based itself here.
I love it, Pete. And can I put in a special request? Can we do a podcast on Doulon at some stage? Because I have been to Doulon and the room where yeah. Foch was appointed generalissimo, yeah. And it's I love it. It's a great town. There's something about that history to be able to go to the towns behind the lines, like Castle, like Doulon, yeah. And see these buildings that obviously weren't destroyed by shellfire. Castle, slight exception because of 1940, but there's something about it I absolutely love. It adds such an extra dimension to the story of the First World War to go to these chateaus that were headquarters, these beautiful old buildings that were headquarters during 1418.
Yeah, and I couldn't agree more. And certainly, Doulon is an exceptionally interesting place because of its Vauban fortifications there as well. So lots to talk about there. So yeah, I'll put that on the list.
Add that to the list. Fantastic. Potential, and also, I should mention when we're talking about these sorts of things, not these two towns specifically, but we did a video which is on YouTube, which you can watch for free. Pete and I walking around some of these towns behind the lines. That's what we called it, World War One behind the lines. So if you haven't seen that, go and check it out, because it was basically, Pete, a fun day where we got the chance to just go and explore some of these sites behind the lines that that you would normally overlook when you're on the battlefields.
We'd have to do that again, Matt, because that's some time ago now, isn't it?
That was 2019.
Yeah. So just
back in the days
COVID.
When we pre-COVID. Back in the days when we thought we could just travel freely. We thought we'd be back the following year. Little did we know.
Indeed. And anyway, so let's carry on. So we'll keep on the Foch theme just for a minute. So a little bit further to our left, it's actually just out of sight from where we're sitting. It doesn't matter. We can discuss it. There's his accommodation. Now, this is one of those fiddly Frenchy, kind of Flemishy names. So it's called the Châtellerie de Schoerbeck, possibly.
I think you've nailed it, Pete. I think that's brilliant.
Well, for those that have listened to our podcast before, you'll know that French and Flemish pronunciation is not my forte. All I can say is look it up. Have a look at where he stayed. So that's where Foch actually based himself. That was his accommodation. And it was a private house, a rather smart private house. It still is. It's on the road that is now called the Rue de Marshal Foch. So, and there's a plaque commemorating the road's link to him, and the house is linked to him. Interestingly, when Field Marshal Haig came here, not at the same time that Foch was here, it's after Foch was there, he also made his accommodation. I have to scribble down a little note here. I wonder if they use the same bed. So not at the same time, I hasten to add. But it just suddenly occurred to me. They would almost certainly be in the smartest room in this private house that had been taken over by the senior officers. So it wouldn't surprise me at all if previously the bed had been used by Foch and then used by Marshal Haig.
You'd have to say almost Field Marshal Haig, wouldn't you?
Later on.
You would. Say almost you certainly. Would. They'd be in the master bedroom of the house. We've seen this at places like Bertong. Yeah, Monash's headquarters, that it was occupied by the British and then the Australians, and then in the Second World War, the British and then the Germans. And always the master bedroom was where the commanding officer set himself up. And I can't imagine they're changing the mattresses every time someone
Why it
in.
Popped into my head, I have no idea. But I just thought, I wonder if they both use the same bed. So anyway, just interesting little
Definitely not at the same time.
No, definitely not. So anyway, others of the great and good that had their headquarters here, Sir Herbert Plummer, as he's known to most people, and will become Plummer of Messines. During that fighting, when we're planning and preparing for the Battle of Messines, this was also his headquarters. But he set himself up in the casino. The casino is sadly no longer there. I have to say, it was not a particularly attractive building, but it was right on the top. We're going to walk there. There are gardens there now. That's where demolished in 2010. That's where he had his headquarters.
When you say casino, Pete, you mean a house of gambling?
I do. It was a casino, but I suspect not while he was there. I don't think he was doing a bit of gambling on the side. But it was, it was the casino. Yeah, indeed.
Let off a bit of steam after a hard day in headquarters by playing a hand of poker or something.
Yeah. So the town kind of, it's avoiding, why I'm talking about the casino, because it was a big old building, you'd think it would be an easy target, but it avoided the shell fire when the Germans advanced to within 18 kilometres. So they were only 11 miles away from the town during 1918 in their spring offensive, Operation Georgette, in this area. So they did get quite close, but not close enough to do any significant damage. But it certainly was in range for a short period in 1918.
On that subject, not to go off on a tangent, but as I said, this is fascinating for me, this area. Just at that phase in 1918 when the Germans were closing in on these towns but weren't successful in capturing them, how much artillery fire were they raining on these towns? Was it simply a case that the Germans fired their guns a specific area in front of their armies, so as they advanced, gunfire got closer to the towns? Or were they specifically targeting these towns to knock them out in hopes of attacking them later?
Yeah, I think it depends on which towns we're talking about, and I think strategically this one probably was not that important. But if we look at places like Balil, completely flattened, I do actually wonder about these places sometimes, whether it's us that are flattening them. Because you have to remember, by 1918, the Germans are running out of steam during these attacks, and it's during our counterattacks, as we force them back from the towns that they've captured, I do often wonder if the damage is actually not that much the Germans, but it's actually us in our unbelievable firepower that we can bring to bear in 1918. So Balil, a nearby town, completely, utterly flattened. Hasbrook, also close by, flattened. And is that because they were taken by the Germans and it's our counterfire that actually will destroy them? So I think it's a bit of both, really. Because Kassel will not be taken, it doesn't have that issue of being fired at by both sides, being fired at by us when it's taken. It's just going to be the German odd shell. So it is a thought that has crossed my mind several times, that the great destruction in 1918, as we force the Germans back for the final time, is it us that is doing the major damage to some of these towns that have been taken by the Germans?
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
I think, add to the list a more thorough investigation of the
indeed.
German Spring Offensive, because it's a fascinating chapter, and we don't know enough about it. We tend to skip over it pretty quickly when we talk about the the history of 1918. So that would be another good one to add to your list.
It's on it. So I'm going to go off on a tangent here, which is something I often do. And some of you will know this name. Some of you may not know the name. But William Orpen, who is a British artist, he actually based himself here in 1915 and I think in 1916, 17. He was backwards and forwards from it, so I'm just trying to find my notes on him. I've actually managed to delete my notes on him. Here we go. William Orpen in Castle. So Major Sir William Newham Montagu Orpen is his full title, KBE RHRHA. Yeah. He was a portrait painter. Prior to the war, and in fact during the war, he's really sought after by the great and good who would like society portraits done, and he painted Haig. In fact, he painted most of the senior command at various times during or just after the war. But in 1917, so it's not 1915, it's 1917, he was appointed as an official war artist and came out to France to set up to draw. And he's all over the battlefield, I have to say. Do you know that's interesting, because in 1917 he's actually drawing pictures of the battlefield of the Somme, so he's actually painting the pictures after the Battle of the Somme in that period when the Germans are withdrawn back to the Hindenburg line. But anyway, so I was just thinking to myself here.
We had the same thing with the official photographers came in, and a lot of the key photos we know of the Somme, you know, in ruins, were actually taken earlier in 1917 after the fighting had died down.
Yeah,
interesting, isn't it?
It is.
Not necessarily the same view that the soldiers had of it at the time.
Correct, yeah. He was, and he actually also kept a diary, and his diary was published, so he's the only, if not the only, war artist that kept a written record, and that was published in 1921. I've actually got a copy of it, and it's called An Onlooker in France, where he kept a record of what he was painting, where he was painting, which is very helpful, because sometimes we don't get all of the stories. He actually describes the fact that what he's setting out to do is to provide a textual and visual record of life on the Western Front, as well as behind the lines. And of course, that's where we are now, so we're going to be kind of looking at some of the pictures that he did behind the lines. And in his book, An Onlooker in France, 1917-1919, he describes Castle. So this is why I like it, because he also painted the place. And certainly we'll be putting up some of these on the website associated with the podcast, so we can actually see some of his paintings. He describes it as a picturesque little spot with its glazed tiles and sprinkling of Spanish buildings, and the view from it marvellous. On a clear day, one could see practically the whole line from Newport to Armentières and the coast from Newport to Boulogne. So you get an idea of the type of view that you would have had. He also, I would have to say, I'm going to be polite here, he socialised in the town quite a bit. And there was something called the Hotel Sauvage. I just called it the Hotel Savage. The Hotel Savage, which was a really good watering hole and was well used. Actually, I've just been reading, literally as I was waiting to start the podcast, I just found a great little site which was describing the same hotel's use for almost what it was being used for in the Great War, being used again in the Second World War prior to the Germans arriving, which I found was quite interesting. So I'll just describe what he says about the hotel in this book, An Onlooker in France. The dining room with its long row of windows showed the wonderful view, like the Rubens landscape in the National Gallery. It was packed every night, for the most part, with fighting boys from the salient who would come in for a couple of hours to eat, drink, play the piano and sing, forgetting their misery and discomfort for the moment. It was enormously interesting to watch and study what happened in that room. One saw gaiety, misery, fear, thoughtfulness and unthoughtfulness all mixed up like a kaleidoscope. It was a well-run, romantic little hotel built round a small courtyard, which was always noisy with the tramp of cavalry horses and the rattle of harness. The hotel was managed by Madame Lurius. Let's try again. Lurius and their two daughters, Suzanne and Blanche, who were known as the Peaches. Suzanne was undoubtedly the queen of the Ypres salient. So you get an idea of why soldiers are going there as well, to rather attractive young ladies, the peaches. He also talks about the press basing themselves here. So some of the, I won't bother naming them all, but some of the well-known people writing for the Daily Mail, other artists basing themselves there. So it was an interesting spot. This is another little comment he made that really made me laugh. It was at Kassel I first began to realise how wonderful the women of the working class in France were, how absolutely different and infinitely superior they were to the same class at home. In fact, no class in England corresponded to them at all. Clean, neat, prim women, working from early dawn till late at night, apparently with unceasing energy. They never seemed to tire and usually wore a smile. I want one of these women. I want her.
Yeah, so, oh, wow. It, that speaks volumes. That speaks volumes.
Yeah. There's some. I won't do some of the other anecdotes. I've scribbled down a few more, but it's more of the same, really. It's it's an interesting
I absolutely
character.
Love that. I love that because we don't often get such vivid, articulate descriptions of this life in an estaminet, you know, a bar behind the lines where soldiers come to literally blow off steam, as we see in these instances. Yeah. But I'd love to get a psychologist on the podcast, Pete, to talk about this whole concept of men, once they're out, you know, constantly under, you know, the stress of imminent death, and then for a few days out of the line, and what effect that has on them psychologically. And I think we start to see the effects in that brief description. But it's I can't even begin to comprehend what it must be like, because, you know, I mean, we're us soft modern people, you know, if I have a bad day at work, I think, oh, I could do with a break, or, you know. But imagine every day in, day out, the risk of your body being torn limb from limb for years at a time. What that meant when you finally got a night off to have a drink and a, you know, and a play the piano with your mates, how you would how you would take that opportunity. It's just fascinating.
I'm going to read just one more excerpt because it just made me laugh out loud. On some evenings, we used to give great entertainment in the kitchen of the Sauvage. I would stand the drinks and howl it. My chauffeur, played the mouth organ, and Green, my Batman, step danced. It was an amusing sight, watching the expression of those old fat Flemish workmen of the hotel. It's just well worth reading. If you get an opportunity to pick up a copy, go and have a look. It must
have been, for the local people of France and Belgium, it must have been a love-hate relationship with the soldiers of the British Empire. They must have been extremely grateful that they were there defending their homes from the, you know, the nasty Germans. But at the same time, little was safe. Little was sacred, from their alcohol to their pianos to their daughters.
We're
at risk.
Interesting. I'm just going to quick do the titles of some of the pictures that he painted while he was there, just to give you a feel. So, Soldiers and Peasants, Kassel, 1917. German Planes Visiting Kassel. So, these are Germans trying to bomb the town. My Workroom Kassel, which is basically all of his, both his artistic gear and his military gear, because remember, he is a major, and so he's got his helmet and his rabbit skin jacket that went on the outside of his tunic. And then we have another picture, the Household Brigade passing through the to the Ypres salient. So that's them going out one of the fortified gateways, which is still there, exactly the same, no change. And then one that I really like, the courtyard of the hotel Savage in Kassel. So he's even got that portrait of what he was describing. And then ready to start, a self-portrait taking in the mirror of him with all his gear on, ready to go out to do some paintings out in the actual field. And then he's one of the final ones, goodbye. And it's a soldier waving to a woman who he's obviously met while he's been there, who's standing in a doorway in the town. So fascinating. I also downloaded a couple of images that of the portraits. Marshal Foch, so he's painted him. He painted Haig and Plummer. So the three people we've already mentioned, he actually paints. While some of them while he's there in the town, others after. But he's it gives you an idea of his social standing. He was a very high-class officer and knew all the right people and was able to go in and paint these people, the great and good, at various times during, after, and before the war, in fact.
I'm looking at some of the the paintings that he did while in the town, Pete. He's got a fascinating style, hasn't he? Very bright. Quite unexpected. I thought it was going to be dull and bright, almost surrealist, impressionist, some of these paintings. They're fascinating. Certainly do check them out. Just go and have a look at William Maupin? Yeah, William Maupin on Google Image Search. Just some fascinating ones.
So I think what he does, he brings a town to life in that period that we're talking about, the Great War, when it became such an important location behind the lines.
Well, that was a tangent, Pete, but one well worth taking. It really does bring, I know it's a cliche to say it, but it does bring it to life when we can actually see what the soldiers saw and not just our modern view of the town.
Yeah, and what I should say is from sitting in our our bar where we are now, we can actually see that building. We can see it's still described. It's actually a restaurant now, but it's still got a sign above it. It has actually altered slightly because it must have been badly damaged in the Second World War, but it's in the same location. It's got the same sign over it saying what it is. It's the Hotel Savage. So we can see it from where we're sitting, which is great. As I said, we don't have to move for an awful lot of these podcasts, but we are about to move, because what we're going to do is we're actually going to walk along through the square. So we're going to turn right. Now we're going to stand up, go to our right, walk through the Grand Place, out down the road. We could do a shortcut up to the top, but I like to go round, and we're going to go into the next square. And from there, we're going to walk up. Why I'm going to go here is just going to mention it, because we're going to talk about it in a little while. This is where the British Army in 1914, in this smaller square, very close to the Grand Place, I can't actually think of what the name of it is, it doesn't really matter. It's here that they set up their headquarters for the defence of the hilltop. This is where in 1940 they decided to defend from here. And then we're going to carry on walking round, and we're going to head up to the garden of the Mont du... Here we go again. Recollet. I suspect it looks like Recollets, so it could be Recollets. So how are we going to say it? The garden, the Jardin de Mont du Recollet, possibly. Well, that was good. That well sounded good. Well, I was convinced. I convinced myself then that sounded all right. And that's where we're going to go. And so we're going to walk up there.
It's like Macron was in the room.
Thank you. This is where we're going to get our fantastic views. So beautiful gardens, extensive gardens. Lovely to go up there in the summer when you've got a little breeze and it's very hot. And you just get the most wonderful views across to the coast, across to Ypres on our right. The coast is directly in front of us. We've also got historic things all around us. The entrance to a crypt of, here we go again, Roberic de Free, Count of Flanders, and he died in 1093, and there's a crypt, the entrance to a crypt where he's buried. There's that monument to Foch, unveiled by President Poincaré in 1928, and it is in fact a replica of the one that stands in Grosvenor Gardens near Victoria Station in London. So it's another casting of that same statue. There's also a full-size windmill here, directly in front of us, which is again a replica of a windmill that from the 16th century. And apparently, at one time, there were over 20 windmills on the top of the hill here within the town. So, for obvious reasons, it's on the top of a hill and it's windy. There's also a monument here to the three big battles that we're not going to talk about: 1071, 1328, and 1677. Look them up yourselves, guys, to see what was going on there. It's very complicated, but it was lots of big battles in the area.
Just that note again, so it's a span of 600 years and almost evenly distributed, three large battles at the 11th century, the 14th century, and the 17th century. I tell you what, the generations of castle were used to foreign armies marching through their town.
Yeah, well, very, very interesting point that you make there. Now, this is one of those apocryphal stories that possibly isn't true, and so I should state this before I make this comment, but during the French Revolutionary Wars, this is where we get the poem, The Grand Old Duke of York, who marched 10,000 men, he marched them up to the top of the hill, and he marched them down again. I'm not going to do the rest of it. So this is where the hill that supposedly he's marching his men up and down. Now, this has been poo-pooed in recent years, but as I like to, a lot of these stories, let's stick to the story. It's a good old story. This is where those men marched up the top and marched back down again during the Flanders campaign in about 1793.
Well.
There you go.
That I didn't know. Why was he doing that? Why was he marching his He's ten battalions.
We're
up
not
and down
doing
hills,
this history.
Willy-nilly.
We don't know much about it, so we're going to avoid that. The other one that I found was interesting, I found a quote from Benjamin Disraeli, who will later become the Prime Minister of the United Kingdom. And he stayed here for a month in the September of 1845, and he wrote a letter to his sister, which said, "An extremely savage place. Few of the inhabitants and none of the humbler classes taught French. There is no library, bookshop, cellar, nor newspaper of any sort. It is quite French Flanders. Their provisions come from Holland. The Hotel de Ville was built up by the Spanish. The Carillon are perpetually sounding, and religion is supreme." That's what he wrote. So I don't think Disraeli was particularly impressed.
There's a bit of a common theme in all these quotes. The ones you read earlier as well. There's a bit of a British arrogance in all these quotes about the working classes of the continent, isn't there?
I never noticed. Never noticed. Yeah, there is.
There is definitely. It's a good insight, though, isn't it? Because we talk about the class systems, and obviously the people that we're describing writing these things are well educated and from the upper classes. Sometimes patronising care, but often right disregard for the working classes of France. Quite fascinating.
Right, so what I'm going to go on to now is, because obviously we're up on the top, we can see these fantastic views, and we need to talk about 1940 and the defence, or the attempted defence, just for a few days. The British Army was in utter disarray. I've been trying to pull together what units were fighting here in 1940, and predominantly there were all sorts of units, and in fact it's very difficult to... People came and helped and then drifted away again, heading towards Dunkirk. But effectively, the task of defending this hill was left to the 2nd Battalion of the Gloucestershire Regiment, the 4th Battalion of the Oxon Buckinghamshire Light Infantry, and they managed to hold on to the town for 3 days as part of a defensive screen around Dunkirk during that period as we're falling back to the Dunkirk... this is the Dunkirk perimeter, as we're falling back literally to the beaches. Between the 27th of May 1940 and the 30th of May 1940. So that's the period that they're holding on to it. Now, there's an interesting...
Just wanted to say here, I think this is really important not to overlook. This is the real heroics of the Dunkirk evacuation, isn't it? We focus on the small ships, and we focus on the 300,000 troops on the beach and getting them all off, and absolutely amazing, obviously an incredible story, but this is the bravery, is the tiny detachments of British troops who'd effectively just been ordered to hold the Germans as long as you possibly can. Yeah. And every hour that you hold the Germans off is another 10 or 20 of your comrades that we can get off the beaches. Just incredible heroism. And so many of these men paid the price for it.
Well, indeed. In fact, all of these paid the price in one way or another, because what actually happened, they didn't receive the order to fall back until a day late. There was a confusion, and by the time they received the order to fall back, Dunkirk had gone. So these guys hold on to beyond the evacuation, and then they say, right, we've just received the order to fall back, but it's a day late, and they didn't make it. So they were either killed, taken prisoner, and a very few who managed to move down the coast, but most of them were captured later on. So these guys do not escape. These are giving their lives, or are giving their freedom for the evacuation Dunkirk, or from Dunkirk.
Absolutely extraordinary. Can you tell us a little bit more about what the defence of the castle during this time?
There's a very, very good... I mean, we're not going to go into the whole story because it is quite extensive. And in great detail, I have to say, in preparing for this podcast, I've been finding more and more information, and I'm actually really enthused about kind of pulling together a bit more of a story for when I take the walking tour, and we do it in detail and literally walk around and point out where some of these actions are taking place, because it's fairly well written up. And you can tell it's taken some time for these accounts to come out, because a lot of these guys were prisoners, and it's not until their later life that they write them. The one that I was using quite a bit is from the commanding officer of the 2nd Gloucestershire Regiment, who before his capture, he wrote it up very well. And so I'll just do a couple of excerpts from his extensive notes and diary, and then account of what happened. So I'll just start in an odd place, but you'll get the gist. This was probably the first time any member of the battalion that had ever heard of the place. This is Castle itself. As it happens, this is a site that has been the scene of many battles, figuring in history right back to the Middle Ages. So just what we've been saying, and no doubt beyond them into Roman times. It is a small town of about 2,000 inhabitants, perched on the top of and around a hill, which rises some 500 feet from the surrounding flat plains of French Flanders. So he's repeating really what we've been saying. The battalion reached Castle after a journey of some in the early morning of Saturday, the 25th of May. Up till this date, it had been a regular battalion of the 145th Infantry Brigade, commanded by Brigadier Somerset. But on its arrival at its destination, it was found that one battalion, the Bucks Regiment, had been diverted to occupy Hasbrook. And what you can start feeling straight away here, units are going all over the shop. They're firefighting, trying to plug gaps where the Germans are coming through. From now onwards, the battalion was part of a mixed force, still under Brigadier Somerset, which included the 4th Ox and Bucks Light Infantry, some RFA, 18-pounders, machine gunners from a TA battalion of the Cheshire Regiment, a brigade anti-tank unit, and some French Army elements, mainly anti-tank and machine gun units. There were also some Royal Engineers, Royal Signals and Royal Army Medical Corps personnel. It's a mishmash of people trying to hang on this ridge. And they will fight so hard for 3 days, terrible casualties, especially the 18-pounders being moved about from defensive position. They're knocking out German tanks. They're going to be attacked by tanks. And it just goes on and on. And it is tough reading as he lists the people being mortally wounded, dying, being wounded and captured, disappearing. Very extensive notes detailing the losses and literally the individuals lost. I mean, I can perceive by the time we do the walking tour that a lot of these guys are buried in the local cemetery. And that's where we're going to walk to next. It's an extension to the civil cemetery here. And it's on the road out, one of the roads out of the town towards Dunkirk. I think we'll be able to find a lot of these guys that are commented upon and mentioned as being sadly losing their lives will be buried in the local cemetery. Now, interestingly, I nearly made a blunder prior to doing this podcast, because I just automatically in this area, I presume that Commonwealth War Grave cemeteries are Great War with a smattering of Second World War, and here totally Second World War. The cemetery here, the Commonwealth War Graves Cemetery, is totally Second World War people here, and we're going to talk about some of the people that are in there, or particularly one, which is very interesting, a little later on.
Tells a hell of a story, Pete, doesn't it?
I mean, it does.
When you described that mismatch of mishmash of units,
yeah,
including
yeah.
some French troops thrown in there, the word that just popped into my head was cohesion. In order to defend against a determined enemy, you need to know who's on your left and right and what weapons they've got and how much ammunition they've got and who their commanding officer is.
Yeah.
Imagine what it means for all these individual little half battalions and companies, and each of them would have a different officer who you've never met them before. You don't know their capabilities. How do you in any way put together a defence in that environment?
And yet they did. For 3 days, they held off a really concentrated both air attacks and ground attacks by tanks and infantry. So they did exactly what they were actually supposed to do. The sad thing is they were then supposed to pull out and get to the beaches in time, and that doesn't happen. I'm just going to read the final part that's actually in another unit's accounts. Very few of this garrison succeeded in reaching the beaches. This was sadly a gallant end to a great fight which had proved of inestimable value to the British Expeditionary Force. For the last most critical days of the retreat, the 5 important roads, of which Castle was the centre, had been denied to the enemy and secured to its comrades by the courage of this doomed detachment. Another account I've said describes it as the Alamo of the BEF here, which I thought was actually quite... It instantly gives you an idea of what's going on.
Well, that word doomed, when you just said that, literally sent a shudder through me. Heroism of the highest order. You cannot even begin to imagine what those men, what they went through and what their feelings were about doing it in order to try and save as many of their comrades on the beach as they could. Just extraordinary, mate. Extraordinary.
Yeah.
And sadly, many of them lie in the cemetery that we're going to visit.
They do, and so that's where we're going to walk down. It's a little walk, because it's about 2 kilometres perhaps, down to the cemetery. It's on one of the winding roads, and this is probably during the walking tour the way that we will also head out of the town and down to the base. It's a communal cemetery extension, so in other words, it's the civil cemetery, and what they've done is added a military aspect to it. So we know this was a rear area during the Great War, the battlefield during the Second World War, and so what we have here are predominantly soldiers who die in 1940, also a few who died in 1944, and of course that's the period when we're retaking the area, so there are a few there, and there are some airmen there. There are also a few French soldiers, these are the guys that we're defending, some Czech soldiers, and those are guys that retook this area in 1944, they are buried there as well. So we have a mixture in the cemetery, but it's all Second World War, which was actually a big surprise to me. In this area where we have a lot of casualty clearing stations, a lot of wounded dying in this area, I expected there to be a smattering of First World War burials, but no, it's totally Second World War. Now, I have to say, I have not visited this gentleman's grave, and it's one that I want to go to, and I've wanted to go to it, and I've been aware of this grave for a long time, and it's just a fascinating story. This is the grave of Sergeant William James Smith, and he's in the Australian Air Force, and he's a Spitfire pilot. And so I'm going to tell the story, because it's just worthwhile telling a smattering of his story as to how he comes to be buried in this cemetery. So I'm going to read a little bit, because just so I get it right. So this is in the October of 2011, and I was aware of this right from the start. There was a historian and an exhumator. Well, they are amateur people recovering crashed aircraft. Some of you may be aware of this. There are people that go out and look for crashed aircraft, try and find them in the European countryside. Some of them are bomber crews, and in a lot of cases, the dead have been removed. What they're looking for are engines and just remnants of the planes to either display locally or to take back to museums in Britain or elsewhere. Well, this is a bit more interesting. This was a team with a historian and a film crew, and they were looking for an aircraft, a Spitfire, that had been paid for or financed and sponsored by the Parker Pen Company. So that was the route that this documentary was going to go down. It was going to go down as telling the story of this Spitfire that had been financed by the Parker and sponsored by the Parker Pen Company. So they went to this village that is where they thought the plane may be. And the village is called Hardyfort. It's not that far away from where we are in Castle. And they went to the people there, and literally the first thing you do is, does anybody remember a plane crashing close by? And interestingly, the ex-mayor, a chap called Jean Bogart, who was 89, he said he remembered, as a young man, seeing a Spitfire crash near the village. So, of course, they thought, that's the one. We need to go and get it. The pilot had bailed out, so there shouldn't have been anybody in the plane. So they start to do their archaeological dig. They're recovering the parts of the plane. And to their amazement, they find that there's a crewman still in the plane. So the pilot is there. Very quickly, they find his identity disc, which still survived. And he's proved to be an Australian pilot. And his number 400942 WJ Smith of the Royal Australian Air Force, who in fact was a sergeant. So he's a senior NCO flying officer. He's not actually an officer, not a commissioned officer. He was a sergeant flying a Spitfire. He was just about to be commissioned. He was 24 years old. And so just extraordinary. So it wasn't at all what they expected. His parents were from Adelaide. And he was living in Whittlesea in Victoria. Went to Melbourne High School. We've got his whole description of what he was like from his service file. And he's going to be buried with full military honours on the 19th of April 2012, where we're standing now in the cemetery at Castle. And I just found it extraordinary and very, very moving when I read the whole story, and that interesting story of him not being the man they thought he was going to be. It's not the plane that they thought it was going to be. He's commemorated in multiple locations. he's actually commemorated on the Runnymede Memorial in Surrey in the UK, and that's the memorial to the missing air crew of the Second World War. But of course, he's still on there, but he's not missing any longer. He has his own grave. We're standing in front of it. The plane wreckage went to Le Coupole, which is the famous V1 museum near St. Omer. And so I presume I've not been, that we can see the remnants of his plane there as well. And so I just... I find it fascinating. I found a lovely account. When he was buried, his brother came, which I find is just amazing. His brother, still alive, came to the ceremony. And he wrote, "I tried so hard to fill his shoes when I was growing up." That's what he said. And then his final words were, "Bill, you will always be to us that dashing, handsome fighter pilot who gave his life for us, for his family, for his country, and for the people of France. We shall never forget." And that was what he said during the funeral service. There was then a full volley of rifle fire from the Australian Federation Guard, and they laid wreaths and the ode and everything else we expect from one of these ceremonies. I wish I'd been there. I wish I'd had the time to go there, and I think I learnt about it just after it had all taken place. And so I've still not physically stood in front of his grave, so I'm looking forward to returning to go and see this grave.
That is what you call an extraordinary story, Pete.
It is, yeah.
I hadn't heard that before. I had heard the stories of an Australian pilot recovered in northern France, but I didn't know the specifics, and I certainly didn't know he was buried here. So, wow, amazing. Yeah. Thank you for sharing that. Incredible. Lovely, isn't it? I was thinking that as you were describing it. Obviously, the mayor had the wrong plane, or his memory had become clouded over the
years. I don't think they would know, Matt. I've actually heard it before, that so many planes crashed in that period during the Second World War as they flew over, that people just got confused as to where it was. So it's interesting to kind of comment upon, isn't it? That means that the other Spitfire is close by somewhere. They just haven't found it yet because they didn't find it. So they don't know where it is. But the other one will be somewhere in the area.
Did you say he was a 1944 casualty?
Where's my notes gone?
That's always the issue, isn't it? Two distinct phases of the Second World War went on here. I'm assuming 44.
I'm sure it was. Let me just check when he was killed. So, this must be on here somewhere. Where is he?
We'll just chat amongst ourselves.
9th of May, 1942. So what it is, it's in a period when we are taking... So I know exactly what's going on here. In 1942, what we're doing is we're trying to take the war to the Germans a bit because remember, 42, nothing is really going our way. It's at a period when Spitfires are being sent out to basically shoot up targets of opportunity. I'll just read, I didn't read it out, so it's well worth saying what it, on the 9th of May, 1942, Spitfire BM-180 of 457 Squadron 9 Group, and I know they were based in the Isle of Man, one of 12 aircraft detailed to carry out an operational sortie over enemy territory in France. While flying at 26,000 feet, they were seen to be engaged by a large number of enemy fighters, over 20 enemy Fokker Wolf 190s, and this is when they were on their way home, and BM-180 failed to return. In the squadron's operation record book, Sergeant Smith's commanding officer wrote, "He was a good pilot, popular, a quiet, calm way of going about his duties, giving confidence to fellow pilots, and he had been recommended for a commission." So that's how he lost his life in combat, aerial combat with Fokker Wolf 190s on their way back.
Seems almost reckless, doesn't it? Sending 12 fighters that far over, enemy occupied France. It seems. Trying to take the war to the Germans, but
that's
seems,
exactly what they're doing.
That seems reckless.
Yeah, well, interestingly, during this period, 1941-1942, a lot of the pilots that had fought in the Battle of Britain, that we kind of know an awful lot about the Battle of Britain, but a lot of them lost their lives, survived the Battle of Britain and lost their lives at this period, taking their Spitfires into France. And in fact, we go past one quite often, Matt. You know, when we go to Fromelles and we're driving from the Cobbers Memorial Park and we drive up to the Pheasant Wood Cemetery and the museum.
Oh, the little fork in the road, yeah.
On the left-hand side, there is... think he's called Bramble. I think he's Sergeant Bramble. I'm fairly certain he is. So Sergeant Good Bramble, memory. And he lost his life in 1941 in a Spitfire doing exactly the same thing. So on a mission over there, and he was shot down there, and his aircraft crashed close to where that little memorial is.
I recall speaking to a very old lady in Fromelles in the early 2000s when I was first over there, and her saying she recalled that seeing that Spitfire go down, and she said that he successfully bailed out, but his parachute failed to open. It's a heartbreaking
it
end
is.
Right there.
Yeah.
But isn't there, again, if when you're traveling through the battlefield area, dear listener, look out for these little memorials. They tell amazing stories. Yeah. There was one I came across last time I was on the Western Front, some obscure little corner. I was looking at a battle, and it was a memorial to two British pilots that had been killed in the First World War. When their plane crashed in the area. So just private little memorials from families and loved ones back home. Just extraordinary.
We have one just in the next village. It was literally in the next village to a chap called Hawker, a British fighter ace. And literally opposite where my children go to school, there's just a memorial there. Now, most people won't, when they visit the battlefields, they won't know it's there. It's just hidden away. I don't ever think I've seen it written up anywhere. But it's a memorial there that opposite the school to Hawker, who was killed just on the outskirts of the village.
Extraordinary, Pete. I mean, in terms of sites that people overlook on the battlefields, I mean, the whole village of Castle must fall into that category. It's been really wonderful, mate. As I said, not a place that I'm particularly familiar with, so I've really enjoyed you sharing your expertise on this battlefield, Pete. Just a wonderful place. Add it to the list of sites I can't wait to get over to next time on the Western Front.
And I'm looking forward, I have to say, in doing more research on the place, and I've been there multiple times, I'm looking forward to going back and actually having a good old walk around the town in preparation for that walk that we'll be doing in October.
Well, if you want to join Pete on that tour, there are still some places left. It's only a small group tour. So the Battle Tactics on the Western Front tour, leaving in October. It is targeted specifically at Australians, but if you're British or Canadian or American, one of our international listeners, there is a lot that you can take out of that tour as well. We already have a Brit and an American booked on the tour, so it's going to be quite an international group. But I think is it 14 walks you're doing, Pete, over a period of 9 days?
Two a day. Two a day with a rest day in the middle.
Yeah, in the footsteps of specific units on the battlefield. Yeah. So we will go to a battlefield, we will talk about a unit that fought there, and we will walk the entire battlefield in their footsteps. It's going to be an incredible insight into how the First World War was fought and what those men went through covering that ground. And one of the highlights is going to be going to Castle and walking pretty much where we've done on this tour, going and seeing the sights and getting an impression of what life was like for the soldiers behind the line. And I'm sure you'll touch on that World War II history as well, Pete.
Yeah, we are. We're going to cover all history. I might even do some of the earlier history. Who knows?
Fantastic. It's going to be a great tour. It's not a standard battlefield tour by any means. It doesn't go to the museums, and it doesn't cover every battlefield site, of course, because we have handpicked ones that we feel tell the story of the First World War. But wow, it's a unique tour. No one else is doing a tour like this, and absolutely extraordinary. So if you want to walk with Pete Smith, I mean, I'm jealous that I'm not going on it myself, but if you want to walk with Pete Smith, on the ground that we're describing in these podcasts, there's no better opportunity than our Battle Tactics on the Western Front tour. So you can find out information about that on our website, battlefields.com.au. But it's going to be an extraordinary journey. And Pete, this has been an extraordinary journey. I've really enjoyed this one. So thank you so much for sharing your insights into the town of Castle.
Pleasure, Matt.
And we'll see you next week.
Yep, looking forward to it.
Thanks for listening to the podcast. If you would like to support the show, there's a couple of ways you can do it. Firstly, you can become a member. For a small monthly fee, you could subscribe to the show and listen to every episode ad-free and also receive exclusive episodes directly from Pete and I. So see the link in the show notes to sign up at Acast Plus and become a member of the show. Also, if you want to make a one-off contribution, you can now buy us a coffee. Visit buymeacoffee.com/battlewalks and you can make a small contribution there. See you next week.